It is a particular pleasure to present our speaker this afternoon. We've watched for years his steady rise to prominence in the Congress and his growing stature as an influential leader in our national government. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he was an All-American football player. He went on to Yale University Law School, where he earned his law degree in 1941 and returned to Grand Rapids to enter legal practice. World War II interrupted his professional career, and he served in the United States Navy for 4 years, being released as a lieutenant commander in 1946. Only 2 years later, in 1948, he was elected to his first term in the United States Congress. By 1950, he had already established himself so securely as a legislator that he was designated by the United States Junior Chamber of Commerce as one of the 10 outstanding young men in the United States. I know that years ago, when I was Assistant Secretary of Defense, he was highly regarded by the leaders of both parties, and he was influential in shaping legislation affecting the armed services and the national defense. It is not generally known that he was largely responsible for legislation sparing the nation's land grant and other state universities the necessity of repaying millions of dollars claimed by the federal government in a disagreement many years ago over fees paid by students being supported by the GI Bill. And for that, all of the tax-supported state universities are grateful. All Americans appreciate the work of the commission appointed by President Johnson to inquire closely into the circumstances surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy. His appointment to that commission was evidence of the reliance placed in his integrity and intelligence by all those who know him. His recent election as minority leader in the House of Representatives assures that he will have even more influence than before, and we who know him well are confident that he will distinguish himself in the post as in all others he has held. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you an outstanding graduate of a public university who has been highly successful in his professional and political life and who enjoys the confidence of his countrymen in a position of high responsibility, the representative of the 5th Michigan District, the Honorable Gerald R. Ford of Grand Rapids. Congressman Ford.
Dr. Hanna, members of the faculty, parents, and our honored guests, the graduates on this day. I graduated from the University of Michigan in 4 years. I graduated from Yale University Law School in 3 years. I'm proud to be the beneficiary of a degree from Michigan State University after some 24 years. All of you have earned your degrees in 4 years or less. I don't know what those facts prove, but I think it can be argued that the older we get, the slower we learn. Or I might say, and I might be crucified for saying it, that the course in East Lansing is tougher than the course in Ann Arbor or New Haven. In a somewhat different vein, I think I ought to reprimand President Hanna because he, like most, tend to exaggerate, and I've often wished that comments such as he made about my football capabilities had been more evident 30 years ago. I'm sure I might have played more and played better. But in a different vein, may I say that this is my first honorary degree, and I am somewhat embarrassed but humble. But more importantly, I think I'm very proud and extremely grateful. Today, each of you cherish this point in time as you face wide horizons of opportunities. In reaching your present achievements, you have proved yourself, have demonstrated capabilities, qualities of imagination, eagerness to learn, willingness to sacrifice, and a readiness to accept ideas with open minds. This is neither a time to stumble, nor to falter, nor to fear in accepting the responsibilities of citizenship with the task of leading the way to strengthen moral, aesthetic, cultural, and scientific values. The challenges are many in this day and age of space and speed, changing events and perplexing problems. If you will, recall what Emerson once said, and I quote, "They conquer who believe they can." You, with your sharpened skills, will help to conquer the massive problems of this century, and at the same time, help your fellow men whose life must be balanced in an unbalanced world. Progress depends upon men and women making and carrying out their plans, prepared to assume risks and willing to accept the burdens of responsibility. In our early history, the challenge was that of opening the West to exploration, settlement, and development. Those strong-willed men and women drove their covered wagons through the wilderness in the setting sun with self-confidence and a tremendous pride of achievement. Freedom to them was a great adventure, not something to be handed down from generation to generation. The challenges of today are linked with new technology, the achievements of science, and the task of filling jobs demanding skills unheard of a decade ago. There are diseases to conquer, roads to build, land to till, social ills to cure, children to be taught, parts of great cities to be rehabilitated, public money to invest and to spend wisely. Seeking solutions with measured, calculated, intelligent, and technical steps, each person must have a choice, without being crowded into the position of accepting one pattern, one way of life, if he has a preferred alternative. This, in a word, is freedom. Individual freedom of action and choice within the framework of the law was built into the Constitution by our forefathers. In the area of government, freedom must be maintained through a bipartisan effort which should receive widespread public support from all Americans. Two major goals must be maintained, must be achieved if the American democracy is to continue to exist and to be strengthened through subsequent generations. First, we must maintain a balance in the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branches of our government as established by the Constitution. The parallel task is to preserve the two-party system, the genius of our democracy. I think it's fair to ask at this point, is it better for a country, ours or others, to have a one-party or a multiple-party form of government? I think the answer to that is crystal clear. Those one-party political governments behind the Iron Curtain or in some of our emerging nations have no freedom and haven't been able to catch up with ourselves. But if we turn to those countries that have a multiple party system, I think the evidence is crystal clear that they are confused and in chaos. But enlarging upon the first goal, that of keeping the three branches of government in perfect balance, I believe that if any one of them becomes too strong or too weak, the foundation of our government will crack and freedom will be threatened. There are disturbing signs of slow erosion in the power of the legislative branch. A buildup of awesome power in the executive arm, and a change from the intended direction in the federal judiciary. Congress, the legislative branch, has been criticized as being too slow to react in an age of speed. Critics have described the House and Senate in Washington as being too cumbersome, too old-fashioned. These critics sometimes are unaware that in the Congress, a system of checks and balances is really in effect provided by the Constitution. When speed is essential, Congress has proved many, many, many times that it can react with dispatch to meet crises in time of war or in peacetime, in days of economic depression or in times of glowing prosperity. It has been said that Congress frequently makes haste slowly. However, the act of deliberate slowness is a real safeguard against racing to the brink of decision. It roadblocks a dangerous plunge. It appears to me that Congress should reach its major decisions only after adequate research, thought, and ample discussion. When the balance of power in Congress is steeply tilted by an overwhelming majority in one political party for too long a time, the inherent system of checks and balances is endangered. This becomes even more serious when the executive branch is dominated by those of the same political party. Although the president is the chief executive and head of state for each and every one of us, he does represent essentially the views of those who voted for him. Members of Congress, those in the House of Representatives, are closer to the nation's citizens because they are chosen by smaller segments of our society. As you know, members of the House are selected every 2 years, a fact in itself which places those elected closer to those they represent. Every 2 years, a representative must go to his electorate for a mandate to continue in office or be left behind. His record is placed on the line, and he must be endorsed by a majority of those in his district. As in the Senate, the House is represented by nearly every major profession, national origin, and religion. Congress, because of its complexion, is a cross-section of America. This is your strength. It should not be lessened by an overbalance of power in the executive and judicial branches of the government. The responsibilities of the Congress are rather clearly defined in the Constitution and include the making of laws which are necessary and proper for carrying out the duties and powers of government. Under the Constitution, Every statute requiring concurrence of Congress must be presented to the President. If the Chief Executive rejects a proposed act, he can be overruled by a two-thirds majority vote in the House and the Senate. It is quickly obvious that a crushing overbalance of political power in both houses of the Congress and in the executive branch for a long period of time tends to weaken the safeguards of the Constitution. Reflecting on the duties and obligations of the third branch of government, I think it can be said that the federal judiciary's function is to interpret the Constitution and our laws. There is evidence, as I see it, that the judicial branch is arbitrarily elbowing its way to positions of authority, disregarding the wise suggestions of judicial restraint, especially those made by the late great Justice Frankfurter and others. When the Supreme Court orders states to reapportion, regardless of the vote of the people, I think the comments of Justice Frankfurter in his dissenting opinion are worthy of note. Justice Frankfurter said, "Such action or assumption by the court is one of a destructively novel judicial power." In this situation, as in others of like nature, appeal for relief does not belong here, Justice Frankfurter said. He added, "Appeal must be made to an informed, civically militant electorate. In a democratic society like ours, relief must come through an aroused public conscience that sears the conscience of the people's representatives." Justice Frankfurter emphasized that the Supreme Court's authority possessed neither the power, nor the sword, nor the purse. And he added, "ultimately rests on sustained public confidence in its moral sanction." I have stressed the need to preserve the two-party system as among the major areas of concern in maintaining the structure of our government, without any indulgence in partisanship, because both issues transcend that. I'm sure we can agree that a strong two-party system is bedrock assurance that our democracy will survive, prosper, grow, and help others in the world to accept their role in the society of free nations. A crushing overbalance of strength in either party for too long a time makes a mockery of our traditions of government, weakens and softens the voice of the people, and places control in the hands of a comparatively small majority. These, it seems to me, are currently the major goals to be sought in the area of government: a sensitive balance in the legislature, executive and judicial branches, and a strong two-party system. But after that, I think it's fair for you to ask me, what is your role in seeking these goals? Where do you start? What might be your guidelines for action? First, you have the mental and moral courage to become involved in the political world as voters, taxpayers, partisans, and I hope as candidates for office and office holders. Those who sit on the sidelines uttering harping criticism fail to strengthen the foundations of our nation. By being a citizen participant in our democracy, not a mere spectator, you develop a loyalty to your community, your city, your county, your state, and more importantly, your nation. This loyalty is basic to personal service and community development. In becoming a part of what the late Justice Frankfurter described as an informal or an informed civically militant electorate, you will discover the meaning of service and true citizenship. Patriotism in action demands loyalty to a philosophy, to a set of ideas, to our nation. It begins at home in your local environment. Give purpose and direction to your role as a citizen by choosing a political party. And I suggest this be a major decision as you enter life from Michigan State. It's perhaps possible that you might switch your political allegiance. This has been done. And this is a choice under your freedom. This too will require mental courage, which conquers fear and builds healthful, buoyant attitudes to the problems we face. Good citizenship is directly linked with aroused public conscience, which, just as Frankfurter said, sears the conscience of the people's representatives. The question is how? How should an aroused public conscience manifest itself? In all seriousness, is the rioting of college students protesting an alleged breach of freedom of speech a proper interpretation? Does a demonstration by more than 100 singing, chanting young men and women in the Department of Justice in Washington, in behalf of federal intervention in one of our states, constitute a meaningful representation of public conscience? Would you say that 700 persons picketing the White House with cries of freedom now, or conducting a sit-in in the White House, is that a meaningful representation of public conscience? Compare these examples with the actions of citizens in a community who band together to win an election to raise money at the local level for a new school, or with the coordinated civic effort to conduct an educational campaign on local issues dealing with more taxes for a better park, a public library, a recreation area. Certainly, police brutality anywhere is disgraceful, as is unbridled, uncontrolled, savage, and senseless mob action, which scoffs at legitimate authority and orderly processes. The growth, the prosperity, the state, and the strength of our nation is the result of free citizens conducting their personal lives and their careers within the constituted framework of authority, law, and order. This is not to say that changes in our laws or governmental practices are not necessary or essential. For example, our present civil rights legislation does need strengthening to give statutory backing to the general provisions of the 15th Amendment, which provides that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Such legislative action is the orderly process to achieve this desired end. There is, however, a fine line of distinction between an aroused public conscience and a demonstration of social revolution. I seriously question the social merit of flamboyant, irresponsible mob action to focus attention on a public issue. We have procedures in our country, in the units of our government, in the courts of our land, by which controversies can be settled with dignity and justice. This, I say most seriously, should be the path taken by an aroused citizenry in search of righting a wrong or in seeking a civic goal. At the same time, public officials have the duty to see that laws are properly enforced. Those who are slow to act in fulfilling their obligations of office, or who deliberately turn their faces from an issue or from a controversy, are truly, indeed, delinquent. An informed voting public, I might say, has the power at the ballot box to replace those who fail in their duties, who fall short of their qualifications, who forsake the public for political gain. Appeals to the courts may be taken when that course of action is necessary. The rules of an orderly society may at times be subject to interpretation by government, by the courts, and by the people themselves, but only in a manner which ensures due process of law. Your guidelines as citizens include a great devotion to the moral and spiritual values which are translated into the nobility of character, social justice, national righteousness, and eventually, we all hope, world peace. Even the most modern of us know that we cannot build the foundation of our personal lives on the shuffling sands of chance. We need something of permanence and of substance in finding direction to our lives. A wealth of permanence and substance, I say from some experience, is found in being active, being loyal citizens to maintaining our democracy in the fraternity of free nations. No one ever made footprints on the sands of time by sitting down. I have mentioned today several desirable qualities: imagination, eagerness to learn, willingness to sacrifice, readiness to accept new ideas with open minds, self-confidence, responsibility, and finally, loyalty. The blending of these qualities is the equation of the total ultimate in personal development needed in our nation. It is to come mainly from the ranks of those who sit as the honored guests today. These are the qualities in man that mastered arts and sciences, created government and law, made cities of settlements founded in the wilderness, built skyscrapers on the sites of log cabins, invented covered wagons that gave way to railroads, to aircraft, and now to missiles, made startling progress in several thousand directions, leading us to the present. Arnold Toynbee, scholar and historian, has said, and I quote, "Our age will be well remembered, not for its horrifying crimes, nor its astonishing inventions, but because it is the first generation since the dawn of history in which mankind dared to believe it practical to make the benefits of civilization available to the whole human race." You have the power. You have proved a willingness to give more of yourself than you receive in order to make this a better nation and a better world for others and yourselves. The United States, I say very deeply and very personally, needs each and every one of you. It needs your knowledge and your readiness to accept new challenges as loyal citizens of a free society. It needs you as scholars, as knowledgeable persons with chosen careers. I have no doubt whatsoever that you will heed the challenge. Your presence here today and the documents you receive for achievement in education are strong reflections of your desire to accept responsibilities in an exciting, turbulent, demanding, and changing world. I congratulate and salute you. Thank you very much. Thank you.